Cam and I are so pleased to have Podcorn sponsor today's episode of our True Crime Podcast. Explore sponsorship opportunities and start monetizing your podcast. Sign up today at podcorn.com/podcasters. That's Podcorn, podcorn.com/podcasters.
How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our True Crime Podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm delightful. How are you this fine morning at 7:09 a.m.?
Woohoo! I'm here.
I got you, girl.
It's always a tough night. It's like having a newborn. Dog doesn't sleep more than 2 hours, so.
I swear to God, I don't know how you do that. I can't. Yep. I've been up since 1:50. That somebody had the TV blasting, so I got up and went and turned that down, and then I turned down the AC or heater, whatever you call it, because I like it cold. And then I continued to sweat, freeze. And then finally at 5 a.m., I gave up and got up and have been up since 5.
Yeah. Being great. Old, it's awesome. It's fun being old.
It's great.
It is. Hey, you got for us? One
a
of them cases for us?
I got it. I got them their case for you, Jen. You ready? You want to just hit it running? I say
Let's
yes.
Let's do it.
Gainesville, Florida is the home to the school of the University of Florida, Gainesville's. Go Gators!
Woo-woo. Gators!
Like many students, 20-year-old Tiffany Sessions is a junior at the University of Florida, and she's studying economics. And, you know, she's just like the other kids, getting really excited to get her life started. As a college student, you need to be disciplined and stay on schedule if you want to do all the coursework and get good grades, which will, hopefully, lead to a good job. Tiffany had learned this lesson early on, and she sticks to a familiar routine to help keep her focused. Now, it's Thursday afternoon. Tiffany has just finished all her classes for the day, and just like she has been doing lately, she's going to go out and take a walk before hunkering down for a night of studying. She started exercising to relax her and kind of get her a little bit, you know, when you're a student, you study and you eat junk food, so she's kind of getting a little bit older, starting to take care of herself.
Good. No more freshman 15.
Exactly. So Tiffany tells her roommate that she's going to go out, take her usual power walk, and she'd be back, returning to the apartment somewhere around 6 p.m. 6 p.m. comes and goes, and Tiffany has not come home yet. By 8 p.m., her roommate is starting to worry, as this is not like Tiffany at all. At 9 p.m., her roommate calls police and then calls Tiffany's parents to tell them that Tiffany is not home. Now, like I said earlier, this was very uncharacteristic of Tiffany.
She's more of the responsible type, correct?
She's cute as a button. Blonde hair. She just looks like that little 80s girl. She's adorable. Now, Tiffany was an only child and the apple of her parents' eyes. Her parents had divorced when she was just a toddler, but Tiffany remained close to both parents. As soon as the sun comes up, the Alachua Sheriff's Department is already out and set up a search station. Detective Kenny Mack was one of the first on scene. He begins by looking at her apartment, the apartment complex, and, you know, he travels the exact same path that Tiffany would have taken on that walk. Like I said, she was pretty much a girl of routine, so her roommate knew where she went, how long she went, which streets and all that stuff she took.
Yep.
So he walks the busy street, and then he veers off to a park that Tiffany would walk in. While police are out in the streets, investigators, as well as Tiffany's parents, are in her apartment talking about the situation and looking for clues that might indicate where Tiffany had gone. Police find her address book and start calling each and everyone in it to see if or when they had last seen Tiffany. All these calls were placed out to her friends and family trying to get some more information, but unfortunately, police are coming up with nothing. Since it was 1989, there was no social media, I can't imagine that, to help with the missing persons, so they used the original social media, television. They hit the airwaves asking for help and showing everyone the beautiful college co-ed with the hopes of getting some information about her whereabouts. This was a huge story because she was like right about our age when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think she was
remember.
Like, two, yeah. Several leads pour in, as they always do, and even a witness or two come forward, but they all fizzle out and nothing comes to fruition. As the first full day of trying to look for her is coming to a close, they realize they're no closer to finding her than they were earlier. Day two begins, and the police decide to widen the search for Tiffany, and volunteers step up to help in the effort. Pat, her dad, was used to being in control as he managed several people in his line of work. Whereas I think what Pat was doing here is he wanted to go at this very methodically and more controlled than, say, a regular father. Does that make sense?
It was easier for him to go about this as not like a father, probably help him forget a little bit more, make it easier, the pain
mm-hmm.
easier,
yeah,
if he did it as businesslike as possible.
Right. He was just very...
Then put feelings in it. He didn't want to put the feelings in it.
Yeah, and meticulous. Like, he was used to running a business, and you do this, and you get this result, right? So that's kind of how he went at it. And I think it kind of bugged the police a little bit, but, you know, he's their dad. Her dad. He's her dad.
Mm-hmm.
So with nearly 800 people out there looking for Tiffany, this would end up being one of the largest searches in Florida history. The search headquarters would be ground zero for helicopters, media, and hundreds of volunteers. But sadly, after a few days, still... they came up with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the Sessions family reach out to people using televisions. Now, Pat was really good at getting on the airwaves and really using this to his advantage. He, in fact, would get some help from one of the biggest names regarding missing and or wanted people. John Walsh from mm-hmm. America's Most Wanted, along with Dolphins player Dan Marino. They did like a little, almost, I don't want to say commercial, a blurb, I guess. And it would run, and it was asking for help in locating Tiffany.
Like a PSA, pretty much.
Yeah, like a PSA. And I saw it. I went and looked it up because I was like, ooh, I don't remember that. And I mean, that's...
it was probably just local to the area.
In the PSA, they are asking for anybody's help in locating Tiffany. And they gave a number to call in case somebody would have some information. Mm-hmm. Now, right now, hope is really high that this is going to bring it in. Something's going to happen. But guess what? 5 months pass, and still no mm-hmm. word on Tiffany.
That's horrible. I hate those cases.
Well, it's just, I'd rather just know. I mean, I think everybody would rather just know, right?
Of course. Of course. It's your daughter. You never not want to know where your child is. Even as an adult, you want to know where they are.
Being desperate and trying to get somewhere, Pat Sessions offers a reward for information leading to Tiffany. Now, the police aren't happy about this, and we know why, right?
Mm-hmm.
He offers $250,000.
Holy cow. What did he do for a living? What business?
I can't remember. I know, but I can't remember. He was pretty good. But, like, people were donating, too. You know what I mean? Like, the public was donating money.
Okay.
She's a precious little thing. Not that they aren't all. They are. But mm-hmm. she was just really... she'd be friends with us. She'd look like us, right? Like, back then?
Mm-hmm.
So, with all this money, guess who comes out of the woodwork? That's right. The freaks... the con men, all the stuff, right? And uh-huh. this is why the FBI, the police really don't like reward money situations. The FBI tried to convince Pat not to do it, saying, you know, it could bring harm to you for that much money. They,
right.
you know, possibly you go meet somebody and end up getting killed. Well, he wanted his daughter back and he was going to do whatever it took.
It's understandable.
The phone tips began rolling in and some of them led nowhere, but there was one that seemed a little bit different. The man on the phone informed Pat Sessions that he knew where his daughter was and she was alive. The caller mentioned some things about Tiffany that seemed to police that either he knew her or he knew somebody that knew her, right? He had some personal information that not everybody would have.
You mean he knew her or knew of her, right?
He knew her or knew somebody that knew her. He had okay. information about her.
Got you.
The caller wanted the $250,000 and wanted Pat to deliver it to him. Of course, and not tell the police, right?
Mm-hmm.
The caller said he would call back at 5 p.m. that night with specific instructions on a meeting location. And what this caller didn't realize was that the FBI was already at the home. They were there when that call came
right.
in. Mm-hmm. So they already knew. Obviously not very bright, because of course there's going to be somebody there if you're trying to find this missing person. So the FBI is getting all ready to record this 5 p.m., get people in place, ready to bust the person from wherever the call comes from, right?
Mm-hmm.
This time, however, it would not be the FBI surprising the kidnapper, but the kidnapper surprising the FBI.
Huh.
Bum, bum, bum. It's 2 p.m. and the phone rings. The caller demands Pat to get in his car now. The FBI wasn't ready for this. They were expecting that call at 5 p.m. So the FBI begged Pat not to go. This is a setup. It's going to be not what you think, and it could actually do more harm than good. Well, Pat is like, no way. Caller tells Pat that he needs to go to a local diner nearby, and Pat does, and he pulls in, and there's officers right behind him.
Hmm.
Now, of course, the kidnapper freaks, calls Pat, and is furious, and says, you know, I told you no police. Well, the funny slash odd part, because the FBI was not prepared, right? So
mm-hmm.
they don't, those officers literally just went there for lunch. They were getting food. They had no idea that any of this was going on.
Oh, wow.
That was the surprise. See?
Gotcha.
Kidnappers give him a new location to go to, and Pat heads out to meet them at an empty gas station, which is located nearby, and is sure to keep them on the phone with him. Pat's working kind of, dragging out the phone call, right, to try to make sure they don't hang up and he loses them forever. It is only moments later that Pat hears the police screaming at him to get out of the vehicle and at these other people to get out of the vehicle. Authorities have the kidnappers. Pat rushes over to the scene, hops out, and is immediately his heart is broken. Just as the FBI had warned, these two kidnappers turned out to be two losers with long rap sheets, and they just wanted the money.
Of course they did.
Knowing that one of them had to know Tiffany, right? One of the kidnappers' brothers had went to school with Tiffany, and that is how the men were able to get some information about Tiffany, mm-hmm. leading the officers and Pat to believe it was legit.
Yep, that's usually how it goes.
August 26th, 1990. It's now been 18 months since Tiffany Sessions' disappearance, when a call comes in to Officer Sadie Darnell. Now, Sadie Darnell is the public information officer with the Gainesville Police.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a double murder at the University of Florida. Co-eds 17-year-old Christina Powell and 18-year-old Sonia Larson were found brutally stabbed to death in their apartment.
Oh, my God, I remember that.
It was awful, right?
Mm-hmm. God, it made People magazine. It was all over the news.
Didn't happen. I mean,
that was more than just the two, wasn't it?
Yeah. We keep going. Here we go.
Gotcha.
The two of them were found brutally stabbed to death. Both girls were mutilated, and Christina was raped as well. The perpetrator had pried off the door from its jamb and gained entry. That's how he got in. The crime was vicious. Just 24 hours later, yet another young female was attacked in her apartment. Christina Hoyt was stabbed to death and decapitated. Gainesville, your kids are at college. Can you imagine?
I know.
Gives me the, makes me sick. Gainesville police are working these terrible, grisly scenes when it happens yet again. Two more victims, but this one was a little bit different. One of the victims was a guy, Manny Tabota, remember? He was a bigger guy. He was actually an athlete. And good for you, Manny. He put up quite a fight against the attacker. But I mean, when you're wrestling with something like that, that's just not going to happen. His roommate, Tracy Pauls, was raped and stabbed to death as well. So Jen, in just one weekend, five University of Florida students were savagely murdered, raped, attacked in their own apartment, like where they should feel the safest. The police and the college community are left in shock. Students were leaving campus and going back home after their parents were demanding it. The killer was dubbed the Gainesville Ripper. Now, just as fast as the killings rained down on this town, it stopped, but it didn't stop police for desperately searching for the killer. A task force was quickly put together, and they worked the streets hard, picking up anyone who may fit the profile of what they thought could be the killer. Police are dragging in anyone and questioning them and checking their alibis, backgrounds, especially if they had, you know, a rap sheet. Months go by when an officer realizes that there was a bank robbery that had occurred on August 27th, 1990. Now, this was the third day of that brutal murder spree. Isn't that funny? It clicked in his head that, like, huh, maybe they're related because he got money, right?
Mm-hmm.
The man who robbed the bank was given his requested amount of money, but the teller managed to put a dye pack in it. While this man was making his getaway, it exploded, and the robber dumped it all in the woods. Now, at the time the police investigated the scene where the money was dumped, it looked like almost like a makeshift camp tent was uh-huh. there with some belongings, you know, some empty cans and things like that. Well, at the time, I don't think they really put it together that that was the same guy, because who would go dump your money right by your place that you've been sleeping?
You would think not, but you never know.
Correct. At that time, police took in the evidence, and it was a tent and some blankets. But inside the tent, they also found a ski mask and a screwdriver.
Ski masks are kind of weird in Florida.
In Florida? Yeah, mm-hmm. right? Good point, Jen. And one more thing they would end up finding that ended up being vital, but they didn't know it yet. It was a cassette player. Do you remember this?
Uh-huh. I remember cassette players really well, too.
Yeah. So inside the cassette player was a tape, and when police played it, it gives them a name, Danny Harold Rowling. Now, Rowling not only has a police record, he happens to be in jail as a result of a local robbery of a nearby store. And when did this arrest occur, Jen, you're asking?
I am asking that.
Thanks. Just 2 weeks after the weekend massacre at the college. That explained why he had stopped killing people.
Mm-hmm.
Police take the screwdriver in, and it comes back matching the weapon that was used to pry the co-ed doors open. Semen from one of the rape victims is a positive match for Rowling as well. The Gainesville Ripper is Danny Rowling.
Cam and I, we both love having an independent podcast. What we don't love is getting overlooked for sponsorships because our podcast isn't quite a household name. At least not yet. But that's all about to change thanks to Podcorn. Podcorn is like a dating site for podcasters and sponsors. Big or small, Podcorn brings together sponsors and podcasters on an easy-to-use platform. You will work directly with sponsors you choose while picking the type of ad you want to do, and you even get to set your own rates. You will never give up the rights to your podcast, and Podcorn will help you all the way, including making sure you are compensated for the work you do for the brands. We've just started using Podcorn, and I really can't believe how simple the whole process is. I mean, we booked 3 ads our first try. So just don't sit around waiting for sponsorship opportunities to come to you. Make your sponsorship opportunities happen now. Go to our show notes, click on Podcorn's link, and start browsing sponsorship opportunities today.
Police now wonder if Danny Rowling could be responsible for the disappearance of Tiffany Sessions. But sadly, it was determined he was not in the area the day Tiffany went missing. While they now know who murdered those co-eds, there's still no leads in the Tiffany Sessions case. It's now 1992, and 21-year-old Beth Foster is attending Santa Fe Community College. Now, this beautiful brunette girl, she was adorable. Tiffany was really blonde, and she just looked like a little California girl, and this girl had, like, the darker features. Just adorable. She was from New Jersey, and she was loving the weather of Florida, you know, because they're not, those people up north, they're not used to that. So Beth would spend a lot of time outdoors doing a lot of activities, you know, just as much time as she could get outside and do stuff, she would. Now, on this day, she went to do just what Tiffany Sessions did, and she also never returned home. Her panicked roommate calls her parents to tell them that Beth had not returned home. Her parents hop on a flight and head to Florida. The case is eerily familiar to Tiffany Sessions. Once again, the sheriff's department comes together to search for Beth Foster, just like they had the few years prior with Tiffany. But unlike Tiffany, 11 days after starting the search, near the area where Tiffany was last seen, the body of Beth Foster is found in a shallow grave by park ranger. An autopsy is performed and it reveals that Beth had been raped and beaten to death. Semen was taken from her, and now they have DNA. Now, in 1992, DNA was just starting to come on the scene and make its mark. It's right. Brand new, right? It's still brand new. The DNA evidence they have yields no hits, but they're thinking one day DNA will catch up. It'll be better. Let's put the specimen aside. We'll save it. 5 years pass when a phone call comes in from the police in Wisconsin. The officer informs Detective Mack that they are holding a man who is under arrest for assault and sexual battery. He had attacked a University of Wisconsin student. While the man was in custody in Wisconsin, it seems he was kind of, oh, you know, those little jailhouse people. They like to brag a little bit, right?
They do. They try to get some street cred.
Yeah, they never keep their mouth shut. This guy would tell his cellmate that he had done this before, but it was to a co-ed in Florida. The man is 28-year-old George Taylor, who is originally from Florida. Uh-huh. Now, Taylor worked as a contractor, and he was working in Florida at the time Beth Foster disappeared. A neighbor of Foster's had told police that she remembered a man who looked to be delivering something to Foster, and she remembered what he looked like. Police showed her a photo of George Taylor, and she positively identified him as the man who visited the apartment where Foster lived. Police move in and take a DNA sample from Taylor and want to compare it to the semen sample that they have from Beth Foster. Now, they find out that the sample was almost all used up during that first time that they ran it looking for a match. It burned up most of the killer's sample. They don't have enough of a sample, and technology has not caught up yet. Authorities are devastated. Both cases go cold for now.
But they did test the DNA.
They did, but they couldn't get enough of it out. You know, I guess it would be inconclusive, right?
Yeah, is that what it was an inconclusive. Yeah.
So it's now 2001, and Detective Kenny Mack, who was always a huge champion and worked really hard on both these cases, ends up retiring from the force. Now, Mack, he feels such regret at never having been able to close either of these cases and bring true justice to the beautiful girls and their families. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes things have a funny way of working out, right? That PIO officer, Sandy Darnell, who took that first attack phone call back with the Gainesville Ripper, decided to keep going and get into law enforcement and now has been elected sheriff. Woo woo.
Oh, good.
Darnell, this always bothered. Of course, both these cases are terrible. So in 2012, Darnell starts a cold case unit. The hope is that the technology's gotten better by now and that the new officers will be able to really hit it, see something different, and, you know, maybe solve these two unsolved crimes. It's now been 20 years since the disappearance of Tiffany Sessions and the murder of Beth Foster. DNA over this time has greatly improved. And it used to be that you needed a lot of it to do a sample. Now you just need a tiny little bit. The police pulled that small semen sample from Beth Foster's file that had been previously unable to come up with anything because they didn't have enough. The DNA profile is established and it is run through the new computer system. And those are better too. And bam, they get a hit.
Finally.
20 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
The police are excited thinking that they can now get George Taylor. They're still positive George Taylor is the one that did this. They want to put him away for good. Guess what, Jen?
It's not him.
It is not his DNA. He did not murder or rape Beth Foster. Guess who else's DNA it is not?
Danny Rowling's?
Danny Rowling. He did not do that either. Instead, the DNA comes from a man named Paul Rowles. Now, Rowles is an ex-con, and in fact, he was brought in for questioning in regards to the investigation of the Gainesville killings. Paul Rowles was inside the interrogation room in 1990, and he denied having anything to do with the Gainesville killings, which was true. So they let him go. Now, he would go on, sadly, to murder Beth Foster just 2 years later. Since he was a positive match, Beth Foster's case is closed. But police are pretty sure he was also responsible for the disappearance of Tiffany Sessions as well. Authorities need to find him, question him, get some information. Now, it's not too hard to find him. He's in prison. Rowles is serving time for the kidnapping and raping of a 15-year-old girl. Detectives go to talk to him. They're excited. They're like, we're going to nail this. We're going to nail this guy for the disappearance of Tiffany. The fact that he did Beth Foster, guarantee, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they go talk to him. Of course, he denies it. He says he has nothing to do with anything. So they need to step up their game if they're going to get anywhere with this. They hire a detective named Kevin Allen to take a look. Detective Allen dives in and starts looking into roles and his background. He learns that his life of crime started way back in 1972. Rolls is 24 when he and his flight attendant wife move into their new apartment, ready to start their lives together. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems like this is just a cute little couple. They're so cute, right? Having the world ahead of them. Nope. Paul Rolls had more than a few demons. Rolls was raised in Pennsylvania by a mother that was in and out of mental institutions and a physically abusive alcoholic father. At age 8, Rolls was caught strangling a neighbor's cat to death. At age 12, fantasies of raping girls started to seep in his mind.
Yeah.
And in his teens, he began stealing panties from the mothers of his friends.
Where at 12 do you get this idea about rape?
I don't.
At 12?
I don't know.
Like, and fantasize about it. That's, I don't understand that.
Not only would he steal his friend's mother's panties, he enjoyed wearing the panties for a while, and then he'd burn them. So he'd wear them like underneath his clothes and then burn them after he got used to
them. Yeah, where does a 12-year-old get that? I don't.
You got me. That's a mess. He's a mess. When he got married, he had hoped that the marriage would make his sick thoughts go away, I guess. Mm-hmm. And they did for a little while until they moved into that new apartment and he met his neighbor, 20-year-old Linda Fida. He soon became obsessed with her. He began watching her constantly, learning everything she did, where she went, who she hung out with. He'd know when she came home and when she'd leave. Isn't that, and like, I'm sure the neighbor doesn't think a thing about it. You know, you're just living your best life there and this guy's obsessed with you.
Mm-hmm.
It's March 31st, 1972. Linda arrives home and Paul sneaks into her apartment where he attacks her. He would choke her to death, but he wasn't finished. He went to the kitchen and got a knife and began stabbing her viciously in the breast. He then picked her up and took her into the bathtub where he left her. This is your neighbor.
Mm-hmm. That happens probably more than we care to admit.
When police arrive to the scene, they find 2 used Band-Aids. And the Band-Aids had toe prints on them. So these Band-Aids were on somebody's toes, right?
Yeah.
They collect them for evidence, but it won't be too long before they find out where the Band-Aids came from. Police go door to door in the apartment building, and they're looking around. And ding-dong Rolls answers the door in sandals with 2 Band-Aids on his toes. He had 2 Band-Aids on his toes.
We got a winner. Ding, 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 ding.
Ding, ding, ding. Paul Rolls buckles, and he admits to all of it. He is convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life. Now, in a perfect world, that would be it, and we'd never hear his name again. But again, it's a true crime podcast, so that's not what happened, mm-hmm. right? You see, Jen, it seems that Don Juan Paul meets mm-hmm. a prison volunteer and starts wooing her. He promises her if she can help him get out of prison, he will marry her, and they'll be together forever, or until he's out of prison. Mm-hmm. Whichever happens first. She goes to the parole board and she begs that her knight in shining blaze orange be let out.
Blaze no orange. Funny.
He's in jail, prison. The outfit.
Oh, gotcha.
That was my joke.
Okay.
That was funny.
Okay. Not really, but okay. But maybe it, when if it's not 7 o'clock in the morning, I'd find it funny. I don't know.
Okay. It's okay. After serving just 13 years, Don Juan, Toe Jam Paul Rolls, is a free man. Rolls does marry that lady who helped set him free. While Detective Allen is looking all into this, he catches it. In 1985, Paul Rolls and his new wife moved to Gainesville. Rolls was working on an apartment building that happened to be on the exact path that Tiffany Sessions would take each and every single day. Detective Allen is thrilled. He hops in his car to drive to Miami to interview Rolls, who is now in prison doing time for the Foster murder. Detective Allen is sure if he can get to him, he can get a confession. However, things don't go as well as we would like them to now, do they? Detective Allen arrives to the prison and finds out that Paul Rolls is in a coma, battling the last stages of lung cancer. Mm. Detective Allen tries desperately to wake him up and get some communication going. He's unable to do it.
He tries to wake a guy out of the coma?
Well, you know, like tries to get him to yeah, like, wake up. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hey, you murderer. You dirty, dirty murderer. Right?
Okay. Well, I mean, kudos for trying, I guess.
Half the battle, Jen. Unfortunately, Detective Allen would leave Paul Rolls to die in his sleep, in prison, in that bed, 24 years after the disappearance of Tiffany Sessions. Detective Allen would not get the verbal confession he so wanted. Before heading home, Detective Allen would clear out everything in the Paul Rolls cell and take it back with him to comb over it.
I was going to say, I guess he's hoping for some kind of trophy.
Mm-hmm. He gets it. He gets it. When Allen got back to the station, he begins to look over all the belongings that he had collected. There were some letters, some photos, just the usual things you'd find in prison. But there was also a diary, and it was a journal of sorts. Allen opened it up, and honestly, he was a bit taken back. The journal had notes about Rolls' victims, their names, dates, phone numbers. There is even drawings of a license plate that belonged to his first victim, Linda.
Wow.
There's a page with the name Foster written all over it, over and over again. You know how, like, when you're a teenager and you write the boy's crush?
Yep.
Miss Camille. Yeah.
Lowe. Mrs. Rob Lowe.
That's right, buddy. Still, he's aged really well, by the way. I'm just going to put that out there. The subsequent pages had details all about Beth Foster. Rolls had mentioned the teenager that he kidnapped and raped, too. All of it is shocking, but that's far from all of it. On a page, there was the numeral 2, the number 2, with the little pound sign, like the number 2, and the date, February 9th, 1989. This was the date Tiffany Sessions disappeared. Tiffany would have been his second victim after Linda.
Wow.
Now, Detective Allen knew that, sadly, this was about the only kind of confession he was going to get, because Paul died with knowing what he did and not telling other people.
Right.
Police believe that Paul Rolls knew Tiffany, took that walk every day, and he watched her, and he waited. One day, he kind of cracked. He saw his chance that February day when she was all alone, and he followed her and attacked her. To this day, no remains have ever been found. Authorities still consider the case open until they can find her body.
Yeah, they'll never find her body. Too many scavengers, too many alligators.
Like, yeah, you know, years.
Panthers, all sorts of stuff down in the Florida area.
So yeah, that's the...
So everybody that was in this journal, did they know of everyone, all the killing?
Yeah, because of the 15-year-old Linda.
So the only one that was left was just the February 2nd. Or, I'm sorry, February 9th, which would have been Tiffany.
And they found the bodies of Beth and the 15-year-old girl and all that. So that was done. You know, they had the proof. But, yeah, they never found Tiffany.
Yeah, that's why it's probably good to, if you have an exercise routine, to kind of change it up. Don't do the same route every day. Because if she did go, she did go by, right? So he knew, probably like clockwork,
he watched her.
That she was able to do it.
She would come home from school, so it was sometime between 3 and 6, was, you know, when she'd be taking her walk every day.
Depending on the class schedule and such,
So that's the sad story of Tiffany, Jen.
What does her parents say? Are they still alive? I guess they would be, because they'd be in their 70s, probably.
They'd be like, yeah, our parents' age. Never give up hope finding the body, but I mean, I think it's pretty certain that he did it.
Yeah.
All right, Jen, that's all I got.
Before you listen to our bloopers, we're going to play you a promo from our friend Kira at Murder and More podcast. Check it out.
Remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Oh, bye-bye.
Love ya.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Cam. For more information about this episode, as well as all the sources I used, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by hosts Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from October Pod VHS. Our True Crime Podcast is executive produced by Nico Vertese and Dick Bain. Make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really like the show, make sure to check out our Patreon at Our True Crime Podcast. Our True Crime Podcast is an OTC production.
Hi guys, Kira from Murder & More here. I am the solo host of the UK-based True Crime Podcast, where each Sunday I tell you about a murder, disappearance, or serial killer, and I even have a conspiracy theory thrown in there. You can find us on Twitter at Murder and More, or head over to our website www.murderandmorepodcast.wordpress.com to find out more.
I can hear it.
There's your lead into the bloopers, Nico.
Mm-hmm. Now, hopefully.
Oh my God. Can you hear my cat? I shut the door.
I couldn't hear
him. I bet you Nico can, because that last time it was really loud. Hold on. I'm going to kick him out of the room altogether.
Okay.
I mean, I'm going to kick him out of my room. He's in my room. I'm in the closet, but he needs to go in the hallway. Hold on. So I'm chasing him out, and I step on Bessie, too.
Good.
That was great. All right, let's go back here. Hold on. I hope you know how to say the sheriff's Alachua. Is that how you say it? A-L-A-C-H-U-A. It's Florida. Alachua? I think that's right.
Well, depends. What is it? A-L-L?
No, A-L-A-C-H-U-A.
Mm-hmm. Alachua, also locally Alachua, Florida.
Alachua.
Alachua.
Alachua. Like Joshua, but Alachua. Alachua. You will Alachua onto my...
Okay. I got you. He begins by looking over at her.
Start that because my phone went off again.
Okay.
Restart it like at the beginning because I had the phone still on and it went off.
I got you.
The video. Do you know what I'm saying?
I got you. I do.
Okay.
As soon as this...
God damn it. I thought I turned it off. The silent mode is on.
I like that song. Just kidding. I don't know that song.
Okay.
You ready?
Mm-hmm.
You get that hairball up?
No, not really.
So let's just put the specimen.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just put
it aside.
Yep. I got to itch my ear. Hold on. It's R-O-W-L-E-S. Is that Rowles? Rowles, right?
R-O-W-E-S?
L-E-S.
Rolls. Like, yeah, I would say rolls.
Okay.
That's I'd say. I mean,
I don't know. What do we know, right? Because we're just stupid boyfriend sidekicks. Instead, Jen, the DNA comes back and is tied to a man named Paul Rolls.
We can listen to it if you want.
Rolls.
Yeah.
Rolls.
Sounds like Rolos.
You can roll a Rolo to your pal. It's chocolate-covered caramel from end to end. Mm-hmm. Okay, here we go. Rolls was what... Rolls was
what? Catches what?
I'm gonna tell you. He sees the connection.
Oh.
He clicks.
Did somebody throw him a ball? I didn't understand what he caught.
No. Because he's going over his background, remember?
I don't know. Yeah.
Detective Allen is thrilled. He hops in his car to drive to Miami to interview Rolls, who is now in prison doing time for the Foster murder.
I thought he'd be in prison for drinking Foster's.
No.
Beer.
That's a different guy. It's Australian, you know. It means beer.
Doesn't mean it's good beer.
No. Amen to that. I mean, yum.
No. Even Australians don't like Foster's.
It's Australian for beer.